Hi everyone, we have a special announcement before we begin this week's episode. Have you ever wished that you could walk around a city and be given a private, intimate tour whispered into your ears in a sultry tone by a celebrity expert guide?
All the time. Yeah.
Well, that dream is now a reality if you're visiting London. Ooh. Because QI has teamed up with VoiceMap, a brilliant self-guided tour app to bring you the first quite interesting tours, packed full of our trademark unusual facts.
And narrated by none other than Mr. QI himself, Sir Stephen Fry.
Whoa. Yeah. You simply download the app from the Apple Store or Google Play, select your tour, stick your headphones in, and get walking.
It's really easy to use. You can put your phone away because VoiceMap monitors your location as you're on the move, and it plays audio to you automatically as you arrive at each location. So it's great. You don't need to check your phone the whole time.
You can do it whenever you like, and like start whenever, stop, have a drink, halfway through.
Do it at 3 a.m. if you're interested.
Creepy.
We've got good street lights here in London, so you know, you'll be able to see everything. We've put two London tours together so far, one of Westminster and one of the City and Bankside.
That's right. So whether you're a first-time visitor to London or a lifetime local, you can take directions from Stephen and see the city from a whole new perspective. For example, did you know that
London is home to over 8.4 million trees, covering 21% of the city? This means that by the UN's standards, it can officially be classified as a forest.
That's so cool. I didn't know that.
I feel so healthy now.
Yeah. Or did you know that our most famous landmark, Big Ben,
keeps accurate time with the help of a handful of pre-decimal coins? A single penny balanced on the pendulum can speed the clock up by 2/5 of a second.
Who uses cash these days?
Yeah, only our clocks.
Well, yeah, only our clocks. That's where it all is.
You might discover how
London's classic red phone boxes were actually based on a tomb.
Oh, they do look quite like a tomb, actually.
So, what's not to love? To get started, just visit qi.com/voicemap.
If you're not going to be in London anytime soon, you can still get involved. You can listen to the tours virtually, just like a podcast or audiobook.
But before you crack into that, make sure you enjoy this week's episode of Lunchbox Envy.
Hey.
This week on Lunchbox Envy. Every day, it feeds about a third of Americans.
It's used to measure national economies.
But Venice implemented a ban to preserve the city's sense of decorum.
We're finally doing it.
It's fast food! Welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Rosie, I'm a chef and food writer, and I'm here with my QI elves, Alex and Manu.
Hello, Rosie.
Hello.
We're here, we finally did it, fast food.
Fast food is my favourite food.
One of the things I do love about you, Rosie, is that you are an amazing chef, but you have no level of snobbery over
Look, I'll choose and pick where I put my snobbery, and it is not it is not where fast food is concerned.
Isn't it quite a common thing? A lot of chefs love the kind of reliability and regularity of
consistent cooking. Yeah, especially in larger scale operations, like big corporate fast food.
Yeah, where precision cooking.
Where it's very precise, it's very repetitive. You know, there is an element of like taking the guesswork out of it makes it so easy. But then again, I have been in a fast food restaurant before where I've seen them go down like a sack of shit, which is something that you say in kitchens when service falls apart. And you're like, the tickets are just like flying out and the chefs are like, and I'm just like, what's gone wrong here?
What are we covering?
Yeah, well, I tried to find a definition of fast food because it's really broad.
Because I wouldn't be able to pin down a specific type of food.
It's
for sure,
massive. Yeah. So I found an article looking at fast food trends, and they define it as food that can be prepared quickly and easily, often really calorie dense, highly flavoured and nutritionally barren.
The reason, you know, behind that is that most nutritionally dense ingredients are best off raw or like, you know, cooked in a certain way. But none of those methods really lean towards advanced preparation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The You're fast right. food like restaurants.
The best way to do it is to make a load of stuff in a factory, pack it with preservatives, yeah. mm-hmm. and then freeze it, send it off, and then chuck it all in a fryer, basically.
Yeah,
at
yeah.
The, other end.
The fryer yeah. is king.
Oh, so looking at the history of fast food, some of the earliest evidence we have of fast food consumption comes from Pompeii. You know how...
Obviously.
The explosion preserved so much archaeological evidence, and archaeologists unearth a lot of amazing frescoes and paintings and there were a lot of paintings of food, particularly attached to like little fast food takeout style
I've
restaurants.
Seen those. I went there and I saw them.
Really?
And not just paintings, but the actual the shop front.
Yes.
That's got an open hatch
yeah.
and it's got a table surface and it's got holes with where the food went.
So yeah, so cool. So they're called Popinae.
Because you pop in and like, yeah, and like grab your food.
One of the reasons they knew people were eating so much fast food is because they had loads of these like takeout style kitchens. But residential homes didn't really have kitchens unless you were really rich. So a lot of poor people would have been getting takeout.
It's that grilled dormouse skewer vibe.
Yeah.
With honey.
They loved a dormouse.
They did love a dormouse.
But do you reckon that you get like a box of six of them, like McDonald's nuggets?
I'm just like, imagining get like six dormice, like pick and mix. Kentucky Fried Dormouse.
Yeah.
But yeah, and we've actually already spoken about the pizzas that have been painted in Pompeii. You remember like one of the first examples of pizza? But when we talk about fast food today, I think what we're really talking about is like American fast food chains, like big companies. And that came out of the US in Kansas in 1921 with the first White Castle restaurant.
They're kind of like the OG in America.
Yeah, they were one of the first companies to adopt that assembly line method of cooking and also having a visible kitchen, which was magical for people who weren't seeing how this kind of food was made.
And then, minimal cooking happening, but sure.
But I suppose psychologically that must have a big effect when you see the speed at which they're moving and you see your food coming out and you feel like there's activity.
And everything was like consistent, like we said, consistent, square, formulaic. And this was so different from the kinds of cooking everyone was used to, which is why it was so successful.
Is McDonald's your go-to? Like, is that your, I want fast food, I'm going to get a McDonald's?
You know what? Actually, less so in recent years. It was for a very long time. It was a really, let's name names.
Like,
we've got
KFC.
We've got Burger King. We've got
Subway.
We've got Taco Bell now, like you say.
Taco Bell.
We've got a few Wendy's. I think I now live very close to a Five Guys.
Ooh.
And that does me very nicely. And there's something very satisfying. I think it scratches that kind of Build-A-Bear itch in your brain to decide what ingredients go in your burger.
Yeah. But I will say, Five Guys, that your jalapenos are unnecessarily spicy. Can you tone that shit down for
me? Also, all of your branches look like toilets. Stop tiling everything. It's not necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And I should say right from the top here, we're not sponsored by or endorsing any particular brands.
Yet.
But we are looking for sponsorships.
Yeah. We'd love to be your stooge.
Get in touch. Let's dive into our first lunchbox then, and that's you, Alex.
This week I have ordered McDonald's.
Yay!
The noise in the backseat of every car on the way home when the parents relent. So, McDonald's, I feel like it takes up so much cultural space. It's the basis of a potentially quite fractious relationship with your parents.
Yeah. My poor mom.
Yeah. What is it? It's burgers, it's chicken nuggets, it's fries.
Mm-hmm.
It's beef, it's chicken, occasionally fish. So a little basic history. It was founded in 1940 by two brothers, Richard and Morris McDonald, in San Bernardino in California.
Right.
So, and it originally started life as a barbecue drive-in.
And then
in 1948, they sort of redesigned it and came up with this concept called speedy service system, where they really limited the amount on the menu. You went to the window and you ordered it, and like as quickly as possible, you get it. Like that basic concept of fast food.
Mm.
And then in 1954, they were joined by Ray Kroc, who came in and got in on the business. And he was the one who really like spun it out into this enormous global franchise.
Mm-hmm.
And if you watch, there's actually a really good film called The Founder, about Ray Kroc coming and finding this, and like it's a little bit, it's not like a story without like there's like this idea that he, you know, shortchanged them a bit and took over the business a bit.
Yeah.
And from another perspective, they didn't have the vision to grow, and he blew it up into this enormous kind of business. So shall we crack in?
Yeah. Please, for the love of God, I'm desperate.
I'm going to start with the McNuggets.
I'm going to go for my cheeseburger.
Can I have this one?
The Filet-O-Fish. So, before we devour all of these nuggets,
mm-hmm. okay.
How would you describe these chicken nuggets?
Nugget-shaped.
They're very iconic, the McDonald's McNugget. In my opinion, nuggets were coined in this country by McDonald's. They all have different, slightly different shapes.
They do, except they also don't. Oh, and it's funny you use the word coined, because actually the process of making McChicken nuggets or chicken McNuggets or whatever they're called is kind of like minting, I guess, in a way. They are not randomly shaped. The challenge that McDonald's has is that they are a heavily processed food, right? Mm-hmm. But McDonald's want to present it as fairly natural, what we perceive as natural. You want them all to be slightly different shapes and a bit knobbly, and it doesn't really make any sense as to like how that would look natural, but completely uniform square nuggets or round nuggets, because mm-hmm. that feels intrinsically unnatural, mm-hmm. right? But as you said earlier, like, this method of fast food production has to be incredibly precision oriented. Mm. The priority in these kitchens is reliability when you're cooking. Like, you need to be able to produce the same result every single time. And so you need to be able to put the nuggets down in the oil for exactly 1 minute, 43 seconds or whatever,
yeah.
and pull it up, and that be repeated across the world, and you get the exact same quality of nugget.
And also, there is a massive regular customer for yes. fast foods, right?
Yeah. You know exactly what you're getting at McDonald's, yeah. and you do not want your fries to be any different.
You're not going to yeah. go and order something else. Yeah. You're going to mostly order the same thing, and you're going to go maybe several times a week, potentially. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. Whereas like other restaurants and pubs don't have that pressure.
No.
The fast food restaurants have to be like, if you go one day and then the next day your meal is completely different, you'd be like, what the fuck?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, that's fair.
So how do they achieve this? They actually have four regular shapes of nuggets.
Oh.
Should we see if we can find them?
Yes, this one.
I'm going to give you the names of the four and I'm going to see if you can find them, right?
Okay.
And then can I eat it?
Yeah.
Yes.
The four names are the bell, the ball, the boot, and the bone.
Boot. Here's a boot.
That is a boot. Yeah, that looks like Italy.
Nice.
Yeah.
I'm going to go ball.
Yeah, that cool. is the ball.
The bell?
Oh.
That could be the bell. I think that's the bell. Yeah, yeah. This,
it's
way
kind
around,
of teardrop shaped.
Yeah, I think that is the bell.
What was the other one?
Bone.
That's...
This one?
Yeah, I think that's the bone. The bone tends to look a bit more square, but yeah, that's
yeah, that is okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There nice. You go. Ooh.
Guys, I see it. All right,
so I'm having a nice. A few key stats about McDonald's. 1 in 8 Americans is thought to have worked in McDonald's at some point in their life, which
that
is amazing.
Absolutely phenomenally
Isn't that incredible?
Large number of
yeah.
people.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah, didn't Kamala Harris work in a McDonald's?
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. There you go. In the UK as well, McDonald's serves about 5% of the population every day.
Wow.
It's just staggering.
It's a big part of our food culture. Yeah.
Yeah. Because there's a part of me to talk about one very specific, very massive brand sometimes feels a bit wrong on the podcast,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
But then when you hear numbers like that, you're like, no, no, it is that entrenched mm-hmm. in society and culture yeah. as like a, you'd really have to struggle to find someone who's never eaten a McDonald's. They do exist. They
yeah.
do exist.
Yeah.
My mother mm-hmm. well, used to come to McDonald's and sit with us but wouldn't eat it.
But it's become like a symbol of Western capitalism, right? When the Berlin Wall fell, wasn't one of the big things like, we can have McDonald's now?
Yeah.
Which is
yeah.
like a legit
definitely,
excitement.
Definitely.
Yeah.
As a business, it's really interesting because it's sort of not in the food business. It's actually more about property. The way that the business operates is it's a franchise. Mm. So
you lease the company to someone to set up and run themselves.
Exactly, yeah. Mm. So they'll own the land, maybe the building as well, but then the person who runs it is kind of running their own McDonald's.
Yeah. Mm.
And what's really interesting about that is, money aside, culturally, maybe not so much today, but like in the history of McDonald's, it's resulted in like a lot of like creativity in the way that one franchise owner runs their McDonald's.
Mm. Yeah.
They run it a certain way because of where they are or what they're doing or who their customers are, or they just have a good idea. And then as a result, that changes the history of McDonald's. So for example, the Filet-O-Fish, which Manu is modelling, was invented in 1962 by a franchise owner in Cincinnati, Ohio, called Lou Grone.
Oh, wait. So do you have an opportunity to create new menu items?
I don't think so much so today. I think it's right. much more tightly controlled, but I think certainly in the past, you know, before the rise of the internet, before the rise of kind of central corporate culture. So Lou Grone, his restaurant was in a heavily Catholic area, and he found that his sales were dropping on Fridays because people were avoiding meat. So he decided to create a fried fish sandwich to entice people in on Fridays.
No meat on Friday. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, the rumor I heard, which I believe was true until recently and hopefully still is that Filet-O-Fish is one of the only menu items that will be freshly made when you order it.
Because not enough people order it.
Yes. They don't make a few up at a time to set to sit. And basically, I remember once doing it when I was with some friends after a shoot in the car in a drive-thru, and we all had to park up and wait for my fillet of fish to be made.
Oh, yeah, that's a classic. Fish. Yeah, waiting for the fillet of fish to
because,
come. Yeah,
because they fry it to order. They make it to order. Fish. And then I remember eating it and being like, that was not worth that.
It's always worth it. Mackie's fillet of fish was my first solid food.
Really?
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That is a bold choice for weaning.
quite classy in
thank
McDonald's.
Thank you. No, apparently I was really hard to wean, but I once grabbed one of those burgers out of my mum's hand and smushed it into my face. So nice. that was all me.
That's all the allergens at the same
it
time.
Is. And I'm still alive.
Another kind of franchise invention. This is pretty massive. First McDonald's drive-thru, 1975 in Sierra Vista in Arizona.
Okay.
This is a little small town next to a massive army base called Fort Huachuca. Uh-huh. And so there were a lot of soldiers in the town. Because there'd been some like issues of bad behavior and stuff, the soldiers were banned from leaving their vehicles if they were in uniform. And so often when they were driving through town, if they were on their way back from something, they weren't able to stop at the McDonald's as they usually did. So this McDonald's basically started serving them through the windows of the McDonald's straight into their cars.
And they're driving off, like firing out their windows. There's a really interesting study done by a restaurant magazine called QRS, who every year, for some reason, they do the annual drive-through study, and they test how fast each restaurant chain is.
How long it takes you to get through the drive-through.
So, top of the list, the best speed, KFC.
Kufka.
302.6 seconds. And then worst was Chick-fil-A, 509.1 seconds.
I would say at least 200 seconds of Chick-fil-A is someone telling you to have a blessed day. That's what they say to you in Chick-fil-A.
The customer service.
If you do a little digging on the corporation behind Chick-fil-A, you might find out some very scary things, but... I've got to say, I really enjoyed it when I did go. And they did say to me several times, y'all have a blessed day. And I was like, thank y'all.
That's the kind of Southern charm that I want.
Have you guys heard of the A&W burger?
What?
No, A&W. Yeah.
So it's another fast food chain. Okay. They wanted to compete with McDonald's, particularly their quarter pounder. So they released in the 1980s.
What, A&W?
Yes.
Okay.
The A&W third pounder.
In case you didn't know, the quarter pounder or third pounder refers to the quantity of meat the burger.
Mm-hmm. So a quarter pound of meat. Third pound's a bit more.
Mm-hmm. It's a little bit more. But it flopped like hard. Apparently it flopped because the American consumer didn't realize that it was actually slightly more meat than the quarter pounder.
They thought it was less than a quarter.
They didn't buy it.
Wow.
I know.
That says it all, doesn't it?
American culture is really getting a kicking today. The one thing we haven't ordered today is a Big Mac, which I think is maybe the main character.
My nickname at uni, by the way. Thanks very much.
Was that anything to do with your name or just your diet?
It was a bit of both, if I'm honest. And I did have a birthday party where I said everyone had to dress up as food and I dressed up as a Big Mac.
Nice.
I love that. So we all know what the Big Mac is, but have you heard of the Big Mac Index?
No.
Mm-mm.
This is really interesting. So this is a financial index created by The Economist in 1986. And it helps you compare purchasing power between countries. So you basically say, this is what a Big Mac costs in the UK. This is what it costs in the US. Mm-hmm. Or this is what a Big Mac cost in the UK 5 years ago. And this is what it costs now. And it's a way of interpreting like the wealth of a country, like how the economy is doing, inflation, in much easier to understand way than just like money. Mm-hmm. So in order to find things you can use for this index, there needs to be something you can compare from country to country that's really like for like. Mm. So you could do like a pint of milk or something like that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, even that doesn't really work because how one country makes milk and you know how easy
also
that is,
whether
it
imports
it, it's really the demand is really difficult. So actually Big Mac is really good because McDonald's is available nearly everywhere, the ingredients are almost exactly the same, and it's been very successful. But there was one case where in the late 2000s Argentina was like throwing up some like odd numbers on the Big Mac index. They were doing really well compared to like the other prices in their country. It looked like they were suffering from quite bad inflation. And so the economists and some other journalists started like digging into this, and they found that basically the Argentinian government at the time were pressuring McDonald's to keep the price of the Big Mac on their menu low. Just the price of the Big Mac, so that it would show up on the Big Mac index.
Wow. As
like, they would, their country would show better on
like
the index.
Like you said, it is literally capitalism.
Yeah.
It is the symbol
of capitalism. It's the thing, the amount of power it has over like world politics. And then the price shot up when they were like called out.
Wow.
I wonder what your opinions were on McDonald's abroad. Because this is something that I get chewed out for a lot by my friends, is when I go abroad, I love to try out the local McDonald's.
Yeah, same. I get chewed out by Tom.
You got to do both, surely. Like, try.
Of course,
try
I'm
the
not
regional.
Just eating McDonald's. Yeah.
Look, I think the important thing, lovely. If you're in a situation where McDonald's is appropriate, then go for it. But if you're foregoing the food that you could be eating, yeah.
The wedding dinner, for example.
Yeah, or like, you know, yeah.
Some international menu items. Mm-hmm. In India, we've got the Mukkalu Tikki.
Yeah.
Sounds pretty on brand.
Yeah.
Cheese quiche. Which country do you reckon that is?
Russia?
I'm not sure.
Brazil.
Oh. I wouldn't have put that past the UK, to be honest, given our family. Yeah.
Chicken parmi?
Surely Australia.
That's Australia, yeah. Italy, fried cheese, creamy stars, what? In quotes.
You can get chicken wings at McDonald's in Italy as well.
Ooh.
Nice.
Mm. McNoodles?
Well, at the risk of generalising Asian places.
It's Austria, correct.
Dive into our second lunchbox, and that's from me today, kids. We're going to Ireland. We're going to Ireland.
That is
basically the way I wanted to approach fast food today was specifically post drinking. What is the fast food we eat after a night out?
Yes.
Anyone who drinks all over the world, they will have some food after they have finished drinking.
I'm enjoying these definitions of fast food more than yours, Manu. Sorry, but like these make more sense to me. Like the corporate burger fast food, the late night greasy fast food, the savior fast food.
What's wrong with nutritionally barren? I liked it.
This week I have brought a spice bag.
Oh, that sounded heavy.
It's a big brown greasy bag.
It's a big brown greasy bag. Ready?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my God.
Oh, it looks
so
amazing.
Much.
So we've got chips and we've got fried chicken, but we've also got, my God, is that like...
There's vegetables.
Spring
there's
rolls,
vegetables,
yeah. Onions,
also,
peppers,
we've got some curry sauce and some sweet chili sauce.
Oh, my gosh.
The spice bag, the origin is up for debate, as is usually the case.
Less of Manu, because she'll be like, the cave dwellers of Indonesia.
Yeah. Some people say it was Tempelog's Sunflower Chinese restaurant, 2006.
Okay.
That's in Dublin. But others say it was the New World Chinese in Carlo. This is a Chinese-Irish dish.
Right.
And essentially, what it is if you are familiar with the dish salt and pepper XXX in the Chinese takeaway canon, often squid or tofu or, you know, it's salt and pepper, but fried chicken and chips and sometimes some other things. Chicken balls, spring rolls I've got today.
Whoa.
And basically it's all tossed in mala spice, which basically is like Sichuan-y numbing spice.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually have a Gaelic word for it, but I didn't check the pronunciation.
Give it a go.
Go for it. Mala spearsrye. So it's like a lovely, lovely spice mix with Sichuan peppercorns, five spice, white pepper, sugar,
amazing.
MSG, chili pepper. The color red is quite important. So I went on a very big TikTok deep dive into sort of like lots of Irish people being like, oh, this is the best spice bag in Dublin. Oh. And I would be like, yeah, that one. As you mentioned, the vegetables. So there's onion, there's spring onion, and there's red and green chili in mine. Now, I had to make this myself because I can't get a spice bag around here. Just doesn't happen. I'm sure there are restaurants in London, for example, that will sell it, but it's not necessarily something you can order in a chippy or a kebab shop or anything like that.
It's a shame.
The spice mix recipe I've taken from a pair of Irish food writers called the Gastro Gaze and their cookbook Hot Fat. And basically they have a spice mix for spice bags. And I follow the Gastro Gaze on Instagram. They're great guys. And so shout out them.
Oh my God, that's so good.
I'm sorry, but that's such a good thing to eat.
Yeah.
Like on a night out. But really, this should be something you can walk home eating out of a bag. And,
Stagger home.
You don't want to touch anyone's eyes for several days after you've eaten this because it's, it is spicy. The brown bag is really important, especially on the Spice Bag Appreciation Society on Facebook, a group of 16,000 people who share pictures of their spice bags.
It's beginning to sound more and more yonic.
There is actually a variation away, on a spice bag called a munch box.
Oh. Which is
even worse.
Which is a, no, it's so funny, which is a pizza box with all of the spice bag stuff, but then sometimes with like ribs and other things too. Yeah. And it's just like even more slutty. So the Chinese population in Ireland, just for a little bit of background on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
They are actually known as Hong Kongers because they are almost all, not all of them, but a lot of them are from Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. They arrived in the late 1950s, 60s. The majority of the early Chinese migrants that settled both in the UK and in Ireland were working in the catering industry because that is when Chinese restaurants and takeaways really started to take off.
It was one of the first like foreign foods you could have.
Yeah, right? Exactly. And so a lot of these early Chinese migrants came to Ireland alone in their teens or early 20s to join relatives or friends who were working in these restaurants. Mm. And then that in turn meant that they could grow and create more restaurants and more people came over. I saw a quote in a paper I was reading where they basically just said that Irish people were really kind to them. And I think that's one thing that we should... I'm sure there are exceptions to this rule, but I would say that because Ireland has historically been an oppressed nation, they are a lot more welcoming to migrants than our country is, for example. Anyway, it is a bastardized Chinese dish that has just grown out of this population of Hong Kongers, but it's very much a late night thing. You go out in Temple Bar, shout out Temple Bar Dublin, and you have the most savagely intense drinking session of your life. And then you rescue yourself with a spice bag. I just thought it's a really cool late night fast food that we don't get here. I was doing some digging into Korean late night fast food because Korea is probably the country that I'm desperate to go back to the most. We went for our honeymoon last year. And firstly, the drinking culture in Korea is sensational. I should say South Korea. It's the best fun ever. Like the definition of lit is Korea.
Wait, they're big into soju, aren't they?
Like, soju, yeah. Soju is just so dangerous. Guys, I lost my bag in Seoul and it was because I was very, very, very drunk. Anyway, so they have a word for drinking food eaten at night. It's yasik. And the core formula is strong flavor plus convenience plus combos, i.e. sets. Exactly what we get in food fast food, like a burger and chips and a drink. So it's very much close to what your definition is. But in Korea, they eat so many different things. I have never enjoyed drinking food, late night fast food, more than when I was there. Because you're either getting like amazing fried chicken and beer, which is called chimek. You can get tteokbokki and sundae, which is like rice cakes in a very spicy sauce with blood sausage. The thing that me and Tom ate and we enjoyed so much was at like 1 a.m. we went to a place that makes a thing called gamjatang, which is a pork soup. So you've got a restaurant with maybe like 50 young people, all hammered, all still drinking, by the way, because that's the other key difference, is that in Korea, when you drink and you eat, you carry on drinking until you go home. You don't stop drinking.
It's, in my head, quite specific to English culture, is the fact that we'll do the drinking without the eating for such a long
time. Yeah, it's really stupid.
It makes no sense. Yeah. Why do we do this to ourselves?
So you're basically given a bubbling pot of hot, brothy soup, and you add in all these different things. So you can ask for potatoes, you can ask for rice noodles, you can ask for rice cakes, you can ask for noodles, you can ask for different types of noodles, you can have ramyun or you can have like fresh egg noodles, and you just sit there and you cook in your pot and you eat this nutritious, rich, spicy soup, which actually, when you think about it, makes so much sense for a hangover, right?
It goes down very nicely. Yeah.
The only problem I have with this is very, very drunk people and a massive thing of boiling liquid.
It's true. It's often known as a soju stealer because it is so popular as a very good, like, sobering up snack.
Right.
But actually, everyone does still drink while they eat it. And it's basically made from pork neck bones and potatoes and dried cabbage leaves. And it's just amazing. The other things they have is like jokbal, which is braised pig's feet with lettuce. Ooh, that you make little lettuce wraps in. Anyway, I just wanted to say that for me, the like, obviously, we know Asia does late night food, street food, fast food better than everyone else. I'm sorry if that feels generalizing, but I absolutely have to give it to that continent for that. But particularly for me, that's the food that I wish we could eat in this country.
Like, anyway. Shout out to the Korean Tourist Board, who really should be sponsoring this podcast.
Can we please chat? Anyway, so that's it, really. That's just all I want to talk about. I mean, going out and drinking and then having a delicious hangover-soaking treat at the end of it is sometimes better than the night itself. Well, dare I say
100%. Certainly with you, Rosie, because all you're doing is working out where you're going to go.
Also because I'm like absolutely uncontrollable when I get into a restaurant after a night out. I'm like, that's it, 10 burgers right now. Okay, time for our third and final lunchbox, and that's from my sweet Manu.
Today I have brought a bottle of wee.
No, Manu. Yeah. You always have to bring something super abstract and gross.
This is a new low.
This is obviously not real wee. This is a representation of a bottle of fake wee. Rosie, you actually said something about how to make fake wee.
I did. Earlier.
Yes, you did.
Are you sure it wasn't fake white wine?
Oh, maybe it was fake white wine.
I usually do have to make fake white wine sometimes on set if you've run out as a food stylist, if you haven't A, got the budget for, or B, remembered to order some wine.
Or you've drunk it all in the morning.
Yeah, then you can mock it up with some soy sauce in water.
Is that what you did? I was wondering why you knew that. I was like, wow, Rosie's full of amazing tips and tricks. Anyway, so I bought a bottle of fake wee today because I really want to talk about the kind of dodgier, more legally questionable side of fast food and street food in particular.
Okay. Oh, God, so, this is going to make me regret a lot of choices.
It's maybe not this one. So when I was in university, I've just moved back to London. I was like very excited to finally try the late night sausage stall. You know, they have them outside Brixton, quite a few stations
around
London. They
have them at Tottenham Court Road.
Mm, yes. And it's just like one dude with a load of fried onions and sausages grilled to order. And I was like, this is going to be fantastic. I can smell these amazing smells. I'm shit-faced. Let's do it. And I approached the store and then a policeman comes up and is like, no sausage for you. And my friends and I were like, what is happening? And then I was doing this research and I'm like, okay, I understand why. The reason why is because a lot of these late night sausage stands are completely illegal. They've got no food trading licenses. They've got no hygiene certificates. And a lot of their practices are like super, super unsanitary. There's a reason they can't get licenses. So I was watching a really interesting video of a trade standards enforcer in Westminster Council going around Westminster Bridge and all these famous tourist stops, going on raids around Central to all of these illegal food stalls. And he was explaining some of their practices. So these stalls are incredibly ramshackle precisely because people abandon them. Like, if you see someone coming, you can run away, you're not going to lose loads of money. So they're often held together with gaffer tape. And this council enforcer was saying that he's seen like cigarette butts up in the sausage grill. He's seen like all sorts of really gnarly stuff. But the one thing that he was like, and this happens quite a lot, is there's a bottle in the bottom of the stall which looks like oil, but it's just full of urine because there are no toilets around where they're trading. So they'll often just pee into the bottle underneath the thing.
You are shitting me.
So that is why I brought a bottle of pee.
But they're not selling that bottle.
They're not selling the bottle.
Yeah, but I prefer my hot dogs with no wee.
There's also no hand washing stations around.
Yes, quite true.
So it's not safe.
Is there not like a kind of romance about these stores and coming to the big city?
I romance of norovirus from a hand wash hand.
Next thing I wanted to talk about was not just dodgy licensing and unhygienic food practices. It's like full on turf wars between people who are running these street stores and people who are driving ice cream vans. In the late 90s, there were gangs that were clashing outside of the royal parks around Buckingham Palace.
Really?
Yeah, it was like a whole
thing.
What
a strange place where there are tons of police to choose to clash.
Yeah, I know. But it was really lucrative. So you could make...
And there's tourists everywhere, of course.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so that's why you wanted to be there.
I see it.
You can make about £2,000 a day just from hot dog sales. So you can see why it was such like... valuable turf. So the police got involved. At one point, Andrew popped out to have a word. He said the smell of the hot dogs and the noise of the ice cream trucks were disturbing him in his royal apartments.
He was busy.
Disturbing him from doing what exactly?
Yeah. So that was kind of more street food, tourism, gang activity. Can we talk about corporate espionage in fast food?
Please.
Hell yes, we can.
Please.
I've never heard a sexier sentence.
So basically, there's obviously a lot of competition between fast food companies. Mm-hmm. And some fast food companies will hire consultants to figure out what their competitors are doing. Mm-hmm. And then feed it back to them so they can like be ahead of the curve.
I suppose they all have different secret sauce combos and
like price undercutting each other on like meal deals and stuff.
Mm-hmm. And like product development.
Mm. I would actually love that job.
It's a massive thing. So there's a really cool article in the New York Times that follows a corporate spy called Mark Barry. He goes through step by step how he would get information out of a rival company.
So that if you've been hired by McDonald's and they're saying we want something on Burger King, mm-hmm. that's how this works.
Yeah. Right? So what happened was Schwan's, which is a food company that makes frozen pizza, wanted to find out how Kraft was making their new rising crust pizza, because apparently at the time frozen pizza dough was like absolute shite. Didn't rise, had no fluff. So they were developing like a really new, funky, lovely pizza crust. This rival company wanted to find out how they were doing it. So they hired a consultant who hired another consultancy company who hired Mark Barry, because the more links you have in the chain, the less suspicious it looks.
Okay, yeah.
So classic espionage.
Anyway, so through just a series of phone calls and pretending to be like someone that worked at a cardboard factory, pretending to be a student researching the environmental impact of certain ingredients, and at one point pretending to be a Kraft employee, so working for this rival company, he managed to find out the types of equipment that were at this new plant they were building, the number of production lines, the sizes of the pizza, the exact number of pizzas being produced every day. And just like an incredible amount of information from half a day's worth of phone calls. And it was so useful that Schwan's was able to not overtake Kraft, but to kind of be a really, really strong competitor in this new like rising crust pizza market.
Yeah. And he didn't really do anything illegal.
No, he didn't, because this new recipe wasn't like a trade secret.
Yeah.
It was just a kind of cutting edge thing that would have given them an advantage.
It's very crafty, if you'll pardon the pun.
Ooh. I was once given a tour of a factory of a very...
with four other children.
I'm definitely old Beauregard, aren't I? I was given a tour of a factory once of a very well-known pasta brand, mm-hmm. and I couldn't believe the security around it. Like, mm-hmm. I was a bit like, you guys are not serious. Like, this is too much.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't let me take any videos or pictures. It was really intense. And now I know it's because of like trade secrets and mm-hmm. all of that stuff.
I just really want to know how that guy got into being a corporate spy.
He was like a proper spy before. So he infiltrated like criminal gang.
That's actually not really unsexy, but he started off as a legit regular spy and then went down into fast food spying. I suppose it's going corporate.
Yeah,
it's
literally going corporate. Yeah. I didn't expect there to be so much crime in this episode, you know. There's a lot of crime.
Yeah, Manu really curved the episode round at the end. Mm.
You're welcome.
Okay, so are you familiar with the Wendy's con that happened?
No.
So in 2005, a woman called Anna Ayala takes a spoonful of chili and there's a severed thumb in it. Oh. And she spits it out and she gets up and she's like, my God, there's a thumb in my chili.
And they're like, keep it down or everyone will
want. And they're like, no, no, God, no. But then actually there was. So obviously the press get involved. Yeah. It's a huge deal. Anna gets compensation and Wendy's suffers massive losses because of this. Because Wendy's is, like most fast food restaurants in 2005, very much consistently standardized with lots of different recipes being used, but they're all the same and they're all come in either packaged or they're made very carefully. Like, it's really, really precise. Mm-hmm. They are able to go through all of their prep from that day and all of the stuff, and they cannot find the reason for a seventh thumb. Anyway,
can't find any of the ingredients.
Everyone's thumbs in this restaurant is still intact. Yeah. Every single person who has touched any of the food that has entered this restaurant has not lost a thumb. Uh-huh. It's very hard to find out where this thumb has come from.
Yeah.
Guess what?
No.
Anna planted it. Her husband's co-worker accidentally dropped his thumb off, and they saw an opportunity to fraud a fast food company, and they took it.
My God.
So she plants the thumb in the chili, takes a scoop. So eventually she gets caught. She gets sent to prison.
It's too bold. Like, it's too... Because you're going to find a person who's missing a thumb. Like, there's, like, an obviously
there's
stupid...
There's always a body with a thumb.
If you put, like, a mouse in or something...
Yeah, I was going to say, not a thumb.
Yeah.
There's a really famous court case from the 30s, which is the basis of, like, duty of care. This is kind of along the same lines. It was called Donoghue versus Stevenson, and it's, like, one of the most famous cases in British legal history. In 1928, a woman called Mae Donoghue was in a cafe in Paisley. Mm-hmm. Her friend bought her a bottle of ginger beer, which came in an opaque bottle at the time. And she drank some. And then, like, after she'd already drunk some, she poured some more out and, like, a decomposing slug fell out of it. Which had obviously got into the bottle from when it was being made. Gross. Yeah, disgusting. Mm. She then got ill and then sued the manufacturer, David Stevenson. And, well, at the time of this case, you could only sue the person who had actually sold you something rather than the maker of the thing.
Wow.
And the problem was is that Donoghue hadn't bought the bottle herself. Her friend had bought it for her.
Yeah.
But this court case changed everything. The ruling in the House of Lords said that the manufacturers actually owe a duty of care to the people who consume your product, even if they haven't directly given it to you. Mm-hmm. And this court case is the proof. So that's why we have basic consumer protection in this country and around the world, really.
Thank Bless you, her for slug. Taking that.
Taking that slug.
Yeah. I would be very upset if that happened to me.
Really?
I once had a live moth fly into my drink, and then I took a sip, and I was like,
I did once. I finished my tea, and then found a very big spider in the bottom of it.
No,
it's not a good day.
That's it for this week's edition of Lunchbox MB.
You can follow our socials for foodie facts and podcast updates. We are on X, Facebook, Instagram and TikTok at Lunchbox MB Pod.
Well, that's right. You can also get in touch and send us your fact recipes and questions by emailing us lunchbox@qi.com.
We will see you next week. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Lunchbox MB was hosted by Manu Onrio, Alex Bell, and me, Rosie McKean. This has been a quite interesting podcast.